Okay, so this morning, so I'm here for this session, but then also after lunch, and there are sessions that kind of go together, but if you decide you don't like me and you don't want to come back, that's okay. But I'm just telling you that they're kind of married, because the company I work for, Ministry Architects, I'm going to tell you a little bit about that first, just to 30 seconds. We are a church consulting firm that started out in youth ministry. My boss, Mark DeVries, was a youth pastor for 35 plus years at a church in Nashville, Tennessee. I have been in youth ministry since 2002, and so we started out in youth ministry, and then along the way we recognized that the things that we were helping youth ministries do actually are... They work in other ministry areas. So then a church that we were working with in youth ministry said, hey, can you help us in our children's ministry? And we said, we can, but you know we're not children's pastors, right?
Yeah.
And they said, oh, it's okay. We've got a children's pastor. They've got the experience in children's ministry, but you all are helping us with these principles that worked in youth ministry. Okay, great. And then a few years later, a senior pastor came to us and said, hey, can you help us with some church-wide strategic planning? And we said, you know we're not senior pastors, right? And he said, yes, but we like what you did in the children's ministry, the youth ministry. So now we've grown into this company that has worked with over 700 churches in lots of ministry areas. But youth ministry is still near and dear to my heart. I really prefer to hang out with teenagers. And those of you in youth ministry, maybe, hopefully, feel the same way. So, just as a little asterisk, all the things we're going to talk about today can apply to other ministry areas, to adult education, to children's ministry, to missions, to worship. But we're using it in the context of youth ministry because that's what I was asked to do. And it came out of youth ministry at the beginning. So there's two components to sustainability. And what we mean by that is we see churches that kind of have these ups and downs. And sometimes it's because of transitions in staff. Sometimes it's because of maybe some frustrated people who leave the church and cause a stir. You all probably can give me lots of reasons and stories that you know of churches that have had kind of dips and valleys. What we would love is for our churches to be the best version of themselves and to not have to have so many deep valleys. We understand you're going to have some low times, but what would it look like if we could maybe have a little bit less of a dip or a valley? And these are the two things that we really feel will help you move in that direction. So the first piece is alchemy. That's the climate or the culture. That's what we're going to talk about this morning. The second piece is architecture, the structure, the systems, the kind of behind the scenes things. And that's why I said earlier, these two things are kind of married together. You can't have sustainability with one and not the other. So that's why this morning we're going to talk about the climate piece, the alchemy piece, and this afternoon we're going to talk about the architecture piece. So let's start with climate. We have to recognize that we bring climate to our ministries, to our church. And the level of anxiety that you bring can also permeate into other places. I don't know if you've ever witnessed this in people. Raise your hand if you know a really anxious person. Oh, okay. Yeah. And when we are around an anxious person, then we have a reaction. Sometimes some people might try to calm that person down. Some people might run away. Some people might get anxious with them, right? And so we have to recognize that everything that we bring to the table in our ministry is a part of the climate that is there. So the first piece of this is understanding when we have anxiety, whether it's anxiety about our ministry or about our home life, our family, it weighs us down. In our hearts, it weighs us down. So what do we do about that? I'm not a mental expert, and I'm not a therapist, so we're not going to go into that realm. But I do think it's important for us to kind of think about that. And for yourself, think about where are you on that anxiety scale? What do you bring into the church every day or to your youth ministry, your youth programs, as far as anxiety goes? And there's something to also reference, you know, as far as if we're going to talk biblically, and I just threw this little passage out there for you from Paul, do not be anxious about anything. Boy, that is a really tough one for me. Does anyone else have a hard time with that? Yeah. Oh my goodness, do not be anxious about anything? I'm sorry. Maybe when I'm 85, if I'm blessed to get to that age, I'll have figured it out by then. If anyone has figured this out, please let me know. But we are called to be non-anxious. I think Jesus was pretty non-anxious. If you read through some of those stories when, you know, the Pharisees are giving him a hard time or people are questioning everything, and you just get the sense that he just has this calm about him, right? So our role model is definitely giving us kind of the pathway and the plan. Anxiety is experiencing failure before it happens. This is a quote from Seth Godin. He's an entrepreneur. He's done a bunch of TED Talks. SethGodin.com is his website if you're interested. But he's in the business world, entrepreneur. But we like to use some of his quotes and stuff from time to time because there's a lot that is happening in the business world that I think we can apply to the church. Obviously, they could use some of us, some of our principles too, but we like to kind of bridge that gap. So I want you to think for a second. Turn to somebody next to you, maybe a friend, maybe a stranger, and answer this question. Do you all know Winnie the Pooh?
Yes.
So if you don't know all the characters, the people that just nodded can help you out. Name the characters from Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh, obviously.
Yeah. Eeyore.
Tigger. Who was that? Roo.
Kanga.
Piglet. Okay, so you got it. All right, you turn to your friend or your new friend who's a stranger but going to become a friend and tell and think about who are you in the Winnie the Pooh cartoon? Who are you? Which of the characters? Go ahead. I bet you could have a really long conversation about this, and if you want to, you could continue over lunch, going into the depths of why you are Tigger or why you are Winnie the Pooh. But I'm curious, raise your hand if you said you were Tigger.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we got some Tiggers.
Yeah.
What about Eeyore? Oh, isn't that interesting? We have some Eeyores. Okay, so here, I just want to show you, this is a little, yeah. I didn't bring a slide about Tigger, but I did bring a slide about Eeyore.
Yeah.
Nobody cares,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
His voice is always like this. We have to recognize that when, and I think every one of us, if we're really honest, can imagine that there are times when we're Eeyore. Maybe it's not who we want to be or who we are first thing in the morning and others are, but at some point in our ministry, we've all been Eeyore, right? So, what if we were trying to be mindful of this and intentional about this and came to it from a perspective of trying to not be Eeyore? Because do you see the cloud? Do you see how the climate that you bring, like I said before, it's going to have an effect on then what you can do in your ministry. When we come in as Eeyore, we bring a cloud with us. When we come in as Tigger, well, we might scare some people, but in a good way, right? So what would happen if we said, we're going to be victims no more? We're going to say, you know what? Nothing. There's nothing we can do about it, but so what? What if we said Blaming others and making excuses are like anesthetics. They make us feel better temporarily without ever treating the real source of our agony. It's much better to embrace the pain of ownership and reap a better life. That's from Henry Cloud and John Townsend in a book called It's Not My Fault. When we think we're right, that means somebody else is wrong. And it puts us in a position to not be willing to collaborate or listen. And so it's not just about anxiety. Sometimes it's about thinking that we've got the answer. And in ministry, when we have the answer, that means somebody else doesn't have the answer, and then that can, what happens? You might not know because they're out in the church parking lot talking about you. Right? But eventually, it comes back around. If you get too many of those situations where your anxiety or your Eeyore-ness has produced a cloud, that's one issue. But then we've also got this issue of blaming other people and people not feeling like we're easy to work with. So, what if we said, all right, we're going to decide the only way to change things is take responsibility of what you can do, what we can do, our own, change our focus from what you can't control. There's a lot of things in church that we cannot control. There's a lot of things in ministry we cannot control. I was just saying to someone before the session, one of the things I've learned about being in youth ministry is that it's basically always unpredictable.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Becoming a parent was the next lesson. I'm glad I was in youth ministry before I became a parent because it gave me a little preview of what was to come. Buses break down, right, when we're on a mission trip, and then all of a sudden we're stuck on the side of the road, or there's just always things that come up that are unpredictable. So what can we control? What is really only the thing that we can control? Ourselves, how we respond. We got to start there. So, if we're thinking more accurately, we're going to say things differently. There's nothing I can do is the Eeyore response. When really, we could say, I've tried a couple of things, and now I'm out of ideas. Right?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, I can't do anything about it, I think we have to be honest and say, I don't want to do anything about it.
Yeah.
That's really what it is. Begin saying, I don't have the choice I wanted, but I can find other choices instead. So we have to maybe be uncomfortable and push ourselves to move in a direction that we didn't want to go. And then let's start by connecting with God and humbly ask for help from other people maybe that you respect or trust. Whenever you're in a situation in ministry where you feel like you don't have another choice, remember that there's a gazillion other choices, you just maybe don't agree with them yet. And so having others that you trust, that you respect, that you can go to, that they can ask you questions and not just tell you what to do, that maybe God can soften your heart and find another way forward. Okay, so here's the good news about climate control. You're in charge in your ministry, right? I'm assuming that you're in a leadership role. If you're in a leadership role in your ministry, then you're in charge of the climate. You can create the climate you want. Here's the challenging news. Sorry, we're also in charge.
Yeah.
So it goes back to that whole thing. Who are you? Who do you bring? Who are you as the character from Winnie the Pooh when you come into the ministry? What do you bring to the table? And how much of that do you do instinctively or without thought? So we have to be really mindful of what we're bringing to the table. And I want to show you this video. It's a really great illustration of how all those dynamics between people can get us sideways. And it's from Friedman. I don't know if you've heard of this man, but he's his theory of differentiated leadership is a book. And this is a great example of how we can be in ministry together with people and hopefully create the climate that we want.
A leader is someone who influences a group of individuals to accomplish a common goal, whether that goal is to design a fuel-efficient car, respond to an international military crisis, or find a new company health plan. Now, there are many different ideas out there about how to become an effective leader. Some suggest that leaders must have certain traits, such as intelligence or self-confidence, sociability, maybe even being tall. Others say it's about technique or skill that leaders can acquire. But in A Failure of Nerve, the late Edwin Friedman goes against the grain of leadership studies and suggests that effective leadership is not about traits or skills as much as it is an emotional process of regulating one's own anxiety. He refers to this process as self-differentiation, or knowing where one ends and another begins. This is a systems perspective on leadership, rooted in cell biology. Take this healthy biological cell. It has a nucleus, which controls the activity of the cell. It has these mitochondria floating around here. And it has a cell membrane, which keeps the cell separate from other cells when they hang out together to form biological tissue. Like this heart. This heart cell is differentiated. It knows its purpose is to pump blood. Boom, 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 boom. Despite what these uppity brain cells may think. Boom, 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 boom. Not only are we humans made up of these cells, we function like them. We also form ourselves into groups, whether these are families, companies, or nations. Like an individual cell, a differentiated person can stay connected to others without losing his or her identity, or without taking on the emotional anxiety of the group. A differentiated leader can take a well-defined stand even when followers disagree, while remaining connected in a meaningful way with others. Now, here's the deal. Some people in these organizations are poorly differentiated, and they act like viruses. Viruses do not have a nucleus or a core organizing principle, so they cannot exist on their own. Rather, they look for other poorly differentiated cells that are easy to latch onto. Now, this may look like harmless workplace gossip, but what they are doing is infecting the organization with their anxiety. They cannot handle one-on-one conflict with another person, so they attempt to rope in a third person, thinking this will lessen the anxiety. This is what Friedman calls emotional triangles. And if you are the one being roped in or triangled, it's so tempting to enmesh yourself with the drama. It's even flattering. Hey, you are being asked to help out in a situation, so this person must really trust you. But don't do it. Don't get triangled, because this only leads to getting stuck and only results in more anxiety in the system. And the infection spreads. And worse, it's bad for you. Friedman says that the chief cause of stress and burnout is not overworking like we all think, but getting stuck in other people's problems or getting triangled. But the differentiated leader is like the emotional immune system of an organization. By being a non-anxious presence, differentiated leaders resist being triangled, which influences others to take responsibility for themselves. This is very counterintuitive to those of us who are used to chronically anxious organizations. But Friedman says that differentiated leaders are able to tolerate other people's discomfort because this encourages them to take personal responsibility. In the long run, the differentiated leader's presence has the effect of diffusing the anxiety in the organization, allowing it to develop and function in a healthy way. Now, about sabotage. Some organizational systems are chronically anxious. In other words, they have a lot of people who are poorly differentiated. Such an organization will be threatened by the presence of a differentiated leader because, in a way, this upsets the way things have always been or the homeostasis of the organization. So, a chronically anxious organization will inevitably turn on the differentiated leader. But according to Friedman, sabotage is a sign that the leader is doing the right thing. And it's the leader's non-anxious response to such sabotage that defines the differentiated leader. This, he says, is the key to the kingdom of effective leadership. The beauty of this approach to leadership is that it applies to anyone at any leadership level, whether you are, as Friedman says, a parent or a president. Finally, differentiated leadership is not a static condition. None of us arrives completely at this place. Rather, differentiated leadership is a direction in life, a direction toward maturity. And the only way we can get moving in that direction is to take care of ourselves. Or, as Jesus of Nazareth said, to love your neighbor as you love yourself.
You didn't know you were getting a biology lesson today, did you? All right. Give me some feedback or thoughts about this and how it applies to your role or your church or your ministry.
With a youth group, you will be able to pick out the virus and see the top of what it's causing, and hopefully you'll be able to quarantine.
If you're a differentiated leader, you can recognize the different fires, is that what you said? Those virus spots, and hopefully quarantine them so it doesn't spread. Yep. What else? Anyone else pick up on the fact that he said that burnout doesn't happen because we work too hard? What did he say about burnout?
We allow it.
We allow it because we get stuck in other people's problems. Does that sound... I mean, I don't know about you, but I have a youth pastor that just left a church last week. Mother's Day was her last day. And she was emotionally whipped. In tears, like snot crying, in tears. And she left that church for this exact kind of stuff. It was not because she worked too hard or she had too many, you know, things on her plate. It was because of the people dynamics, not the people, but the dynamics of the toxic, chronic anxiety stuff. So you are in charge in some way in your ministry, and so we have to recognize that when we come to the table, if we can come as a self-differentiated leader, that will influence what our ministry is like. So we need to, then also, there's all kinds of other people involved though, right? So we have all these other people and all this other stuff to think about. So the first thing is being mindful of yourself and being, if possible, emotionally detached from other people's problems. And then the next thing is we have to think about moving from content thinking to systems thinking. And what I mean by this is a lot of times in ministry, when we have a problem, what do? We try to solve the problem, right? We don't have enough kids coming to Sunday school. Is that a problem for a lot of people? Yes. So what do? We try to figure out ways to get more kids to come to Sunday school. What we're saying is, instead of focusing on the content of the problem, let's create systems around it that kind of move us towards a solution, but isn't focused straight in on it. So when we're doing this, we've got climate is one of those things in the system. If you are in a church that has a lot of frustrated people or a lot of people that are tense or anxious, it's really hard to change things. It's really hard to try something new. So before we go and try to change something or implement something new, we have to recognize that the climate of our ministry, of the church, needs tending to first. There is a high cost of ignoring the climate. It's kind of like there's been some flooding here recently, right? What would happen if we didn't put all of the sandbags out? It'd be a lot worse. We react to the weather when there's a tornado coming through, when there's a lot of rain. And if we don't react to that, if we don't do some preventative things, there's a high cost. It's the same thing in church. So we want to think about our responsibilities in a different way. Flipping the pyramid, and what I mean by that is we want to think about climate first. A lot of times in church, we work on the task, right? We have all these things we have to get done. We got to get the bulletin announcements done. We got to do our lesson for Sunday, yada, yada, yada. And then we think about, the vision, how it's tied to that task. And then maybe if we're lucky, we think about the climate. What I'm saying is let's flip it. Let's think about the climate first. Let's make sure we're in a very healthy, non-anxious place. Then let's think about the vision, and then we'll do the task. So if we can come to our ministry in that way, that's where we're going to move towards sustainability. I want you to turn to your partner or your friend or a new friend, and you're going to answer this question in 30 seconds or less. What's the weather report in your ministry? What do you think of when you think of your ministry? Is it sunny and 75? Is there a tornado headed your way or something in between? Just take a couple of minutes, share with each other. If you haven't had the second person chat, go ahead and switch and share. Kinds of things you can talk about at lunch. We're going to come back together, but another lunch conversation if you want it to expand on that. Would you mind some of you sharing what your weather report is? Tell us what you shared with your friend.
We looked at it from youth ministry and as the whole church.
Okay.
Seeing how they compared the youth ministry, it's mostly cloudy with some sunshine, but as a church, there's a little bit more sunshine because there's less focus, because there's not a lot of students, and so it's kind of a differentiation back and forth between the whole church and one particular ministry.
Right. You absolutely need to think about it from the whole church, big church perspective, and then your ministry area. So, so youth ministry has its own climate, but then you're influenced or impacted by the climate of the church. Absolutely. Yes?
Our church was going back to our church has gone down in attendance, and slowly we are becoming an older church, okay, of 50s to 80s, all right? Currently, we have 22 kids coming on Wednesday nights.
Wow.
We do not have the volunteers. Mm-hmm. So what do you do with an 80 population that says, well, I've already raised my children, I've already done that 20 years ago.
Yes.
And you don't have any other people that are willing to help.
Yeah. Great question. So what do you do when you've got a church of 50 to 80 year olds, but we got 22 kids coming and we don't have enough volunteers on Wednesday nights?
We don't have the kids that come on Sunday. We have the kids.
Kids are coming during the week, not on Sunday. So it's a different group of kids on Wednesday night. So what do you do? That's a great teaser for after lunch.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to talk about more specifically, but in a minute we're going
to
talk about
next,
yeah, no.
Look.
Yeah, and then for only $9.99. No. but in a minute we're going to talk about so normally, or what some churches would do is say, let's go get more volunteers. We got to go get more volunteers, right? That's the content.
Where are they?
They're in your 50 to 80 year old population. But we have to create the system. She's giving me that face like, you do not know what you're talking about, lady. So we have to create the system to move into the direction of solving that problem. And the climate is the first thing. And in just a minute, we're going to talk through how do we get that climate where we want it to be? How can we get your 50 to 80 year olds to recognize that they are the church, that this is their way to serve, that this is their place in ministry? That, you know, those are all the things that we've got to plant those seeds.
Is there something more than just slowing down to get your eyes off of the problem and back on the climate? You know what I mean? Because you're talking about not being anxious, and I get that. But is there something else, too, that's practical to say, okay, how do I keep from going? Because that's where we want to go. We all want to go there. That's where they're going. They want to go to the problem. So is there something other than just patience? Is there something else that you can say, hey, look, here's something else that you can do to kind of keep your eyes off?
Great question. Another teaser to this afternoon.
Oh,
but see, this is why they're bridged, they're married together, right? So it's really important to have balcony time in your week. So when you're thinking about what you do in ministry, to have an hour or two at least a week where you're pulling yourself out of all the tasks, all of the deadlines, all of the things that need to happen, and you're saying, I'm going in the balcony, I'm going to look at the church from up here, 30,000 feet. What are those things that you see from that perspective? Like, we got to figure out Wednesday night. Not just for this week, but like for 6 months from now or a year from now. We got to figure this out. This is a long-term problem. This is a strategic decision we need to make. So you need to allow yourself to have that time in your week regularly so that you can pull yourself out of the day-to-day and give yourself that space to think through those situations and have potentially other people that you can bounce ideas around, not make decisions, but bounce ideas around, maybe even have some prayer time. I don't know, God sometimes has answers, right, when we listen? But it's kind of centered around being able to pull yourself out of that on a weekly basis so that you're actually changing the way that you're running. You're not in the mode of to do, get it done, check off my list. Balcony time is one of the things that, when we talk about time management, that we really encourage people to schedule your week around it, not make it fit into the crevices. And those are the kind of conversations that maybe 1 week your balcony time is with a group of volunteers. You gather around and you have a meeting for an hour and you say, this is not a meeting to solve the problem. This is a meeting to brainstorm. Let's think of all the different ways. And if we don't have 7 ways by the time we leave here, then we haven't done our job. The other thing to keep in mind is we really are big on failure. When I say we, ministry architects, we really feel like if you haven't failed 3 or 4 times, then you haven't done enough. In church, we like to be perfect, right? We don't want people to see our warts. We want to make sure that we're putting out our best front. And when we do that, we are not allowing ourselves to get to maybe the best solution because we stop. When something doesn't go well, We just cut it off and we move on, or we never do anything again. If it goes well, then we have the first annual whatever until the rapture, and we do that thing over and over and over again until it dies, right? So we really believe that ministry is failure without losing enthusiasm. I think it was Winston Churchill that said that originally, that we want to imagine that we just failure one after another without losing enthusiasm, because eventually something's going to stick. So if we have a solution to the problem on Wednesday night and it doesn't work, well, good. Now we can move on to the next one. And we just keep going and keep going and keep going. And if you haven't tried three or four things, then probably haven't done enough. And then it's back to the Eeyore, right? Nothing I do works around here. I don't have any volunteers. I've tried it, everything. When I've asked that question to ministry staff before, what have you tried? I sent out an email. Okay, what else have you tried? I put it in the bulletin. I emailed people, I put it in the bulletin, and nobody wants to volunteer. And I said, well, there's about five more things that you haven't done. And one of those things is, if you have not called every single person in your church directory, then you have not done everything. So we've got a $100 challenge coming later this afternoon. I'll give you $100 if you do this thing for volunteer recruitment and it doesn't work. But we really do believe we have to remember our mindset has to change, and we have to be okay with failing. If we're not okay with failing, then we're probably going to get stuck, and we're probably going to not figure out what needs to happen. Okay, any other questions before we move on? Oh, other weather reports that anyone wanted to share? Okay, that's all right. Lunch conversation again. Okay, so how are we going to do this? Oh, here's another question for you to think about. We're not going to go right now, but what stories, this is a question that might be good for you to talk with your volunteers or your other staff at your church about. What stories or metaphors define your climate? What would people say about your ministry? What stories would they tell? Is it, it's such a fun place, and insert the story? Or is it a different story? So think about that, because the stories we tell definitely plays into the climate that we have. Okay, so here's a few ways. These are the actual practical steps now for how to, you know, create the climate you want. The first thing is, you have to trust the process, what we're about to go through, and recognize that this is not a quick fix. Do you know the Staples commercial with the button?
That was easy.
Yeah, this is not that Staples easy button. It's kind of the opposite, actually. So we have to recognize that this is more like bamboo. When bamboo grows, it will lay dormant for years. And then I think it's like in a 24-hour period, it'll just skyrocket up. Kind of like junior high boys sometimes, you know? Like, we just don't know what's going on. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they just, whoa, you were listening. Okay. So this is one of those situations where we have to recognize that it might be the bamboo is lying dormant, but everything we're putting into this, we have to trust the process and recognize that maybe overnight it'll just feel like all of a sudden you've got the change you were looking for, the climate you were looking for. Deliver results. And what I mean by this is, you have to be able to show your leadership in your church, show your parents, show your church members that there are things happening beyond the actual weekly programming that you're doing. Have target numbers. I know people kind of get a little bit weird when we talk about numbers, but I don't know about you. In my church, we actually have a thing where we all stand up when a baby is baptized, and we say we're going to actually be a part of the, you know, Christian growth and faith development of this child. And so that person then becomes a number, in a sense. And so we have to recognize that when people are a part of our congregation, part of our church, that's a number that matters, right? So when we say in our ministry we have target numbers, what we're saying is you're deciding what efforts are you going to go to stay connected to those kids that you know are your babies? You know they're a part of your church family. And then if you have target numbers, you can share that with your leadership, and then you can give them a sense of what you're doing to actually stay connected to them. So good numbers to think about are, what are your numbers for your weekly programming that you want to see? You know, how many kids do you want to see come to a Wednesday night or a Sunday morning program? How many kids do we want to see over the summer? How many visitors do you want to connect with in the course of the year? How many overall children or youth do you want in a quarter or in a year to have connections to? How many volunteers? All of those are good numbers to think about. And when you deliver those results, you're helping kind of lower the anxiety and provide that sunny in 75. The next thing we want to do is embrace those stories and metaphors. And you, this is where you as the leader really have, you're in charge. You get to decide which stories are told. Here's an example. About 15 years ago, I was at a church in Nashville, Tennessee, and Youth Sunday is a really big deal there. This church was about 3,000 members. We had 450 youth, 6th through 12th grade on the roster. And so Youth Sunday, we had probably 100-150 kids, 6th through 12th grade up in front. And, you know, they do the whole service. They're singing, they're doing everything. And at the end, you know, our pastor is shaking hands and everybody's telling them how beautiful it was and how moved they are. And it's a wonderful example of the church supporting the youth ministry giving back, right? That's the story I'm telling you. What I didn't say was that about five of the girls had dresses that went to here and shirts that went to here.
Yeah.
And those of us on the staff were sweating bullets because they're up there bouncing around, singing their song with not a lot of clothes on. I didn't tell you that story at first, right? The way that we share information can influence and impact the climate. Everything that you share, even an announcement in the bulletin, the way you share it, or in the newsletter, or an email that goes out, everything that you say is telling a story. So when we put in the bulletin, we need volunteers for Wednesday night, what story does that tell? It might tell a story of, we're desperate, we'll take anyone.
Right.
Well, you will until I tell you that our, in ministry architect's language, we call that the call for child predators.
Yeah.
Because when we send out a blanket appeal, we'll take anyone. Well, really? If someone walks through the door and reads that, we have to be careful. We really do. And so everything that you do, everything that you share, you want to be mindful of how you're saying it. So for Wednesday night, you know, maybe the bulletin is not the best place to say we need volunteers, but maybe we celebrate something about Wednesday night. We're so grateful and we're praising God for the 22 kids that we have on Wednesday night. And then put a picture. You know, so in a way it's marketing, right? But we have to recognize that everything that we communicate out is telling a story. So be really mindful of the stories you tell and the metaphors that you have. And if you don't feel like you have any metaphors or stories, then now is the time to start coming up with some that are going to help you with your climate. That could go in balcony time as well. What are some stories that I need to generate, or what are some metaphors that we need to really get circulating out there? And share them with people that can be your advocates for the ministry too. We need to celebrate rituals and traditions. How many of you have rituals like blessing of the backpacks or senior graduation dinner? You know, some people are shaking their heads. So, you know, we have these things that we do that we celebrate kids at different points in their life, maybe when they're entering the ministry or leaving the ministry. But we want to make sure that those don't get stale, and that it's not just this thing that we always do. So anything that you can do to spice that up, to make it feel fresh and new for every class, make it feel like it's a really big deal. Because our children, I mean, I hate to say it, they probably are not going to remember the Sunday school lessons as much as they're going to remember the senior dinner, right? I mean, I think their faith will be impacted by the teaching, obviously. But when they think back on their experience in their youth ministry, it's more likely that they're going to remember the people and those kind of big major events. And so anytime you can create a special tradition or ritual for them, you are creating that climate. You're putting money in the bank towards being able to then move forward with new ideas or recruiting more people. Because imagine a room full of seniors that have invited, not just their parents are invited, but maybe they get to pick one or two people who've made an impact in their life or that they see Jesus in. And they get to bring those people to this banquet. If you do that a few times, those 60-year-olds are going to want to be in that room, right? Because then all of a sudden there's this thing that's happening where the people of the church are recognizing how they can have an impact in a kid's life. And it can be contagious. I think we have to recognize that we have an awesome opportunity to infect the adults of our church with this incredible gift of being connected to teenagers. And not everybody, it's not for everyone, I get that. But I've seen it time and time again where, you know, someone who wasn't thinking they'd be good at this, you know, I don't really know anything about this teenager stuff, and then they get locked in. I had a volunteer in Collinsville, Illinois, actually. He was a former Marine, had never done youth ministry in his life, and at the age of 67, I asked him to be a youth group volunteer. And by year two, he was not just there, he was in the middle of the dodgeball game, like playing dodgeball, went on the ski trip with us, broke a rib, but he went on the ski trip with us. And his wife would say to me, every time he comes home, I am so worried when he walks through that door that he's going to be injured. But I let it go because he has the biggest smile on his face.
Yeah.
And wouldn't you know that about 3 years into it, he was diagnosed with brain cancer. And our kids thought of him like a grandpa. And it was incredible to see them come around him and his family, write cards to him, pray for him, be there for him. And to think that that might not have happened if we wouldn't have recognized that he could be a volunteer in that ministry. Those are the kinds of things then that becomes infectious, because then he and his wife are telling their friends, who are all 70, about how the teenagers did all these things for them, right? And so those are the stories that then get told, and then people start to recognize that, oh, maybe this is something that could apply to me. So we have to recognize how important it is, those traditions, those rituals. It became a funny thing that we would, like, every week we'd say, which bone is Clancy going to break tonight?
Yeah.
You know? Okay. So think about the ways that you can create traditions in your ministry and the rituals that you can do. Maybe it's having a funny name, like for your group. Or, you know, Mark DeVries, my boss, said when he was in high school, they all spoke in a British accent. And that was their thing in his youth ministry. You know, so it doesn't necessarily matter what it is, as long as it's something that your kids and your group feels like is identity forming. So celebrate those things and recognize that they are very important. Import joy into the chaos. If you're in youth ministry, you know it's chaotic, and in church in general, it can be chaotic. And we just always have to remember that we have an opportunity to be Tigger when no one else wants to be. And I see somebody bouncing in the back. It's really important to remember this. I'm still learning this as a parent, by the way. I don't do a good job of this in parenting. I do a much better job of this in ministry, and here's the example. When my kids don't do what I want, I just go straight to that serious, angry mom with the look on my face that, I said, do that, or no, and does that work? No, it never works. I'm learning. When I can remove my emotion from the situation and be goofy with them in the moment where I'm really frustrated, unbelievable what happens, right? It gets their attention. All of a sudden, they're listening to me again. So, you know, I realized a couple years ago that when my four-year-old at the time was not doing what I wanted, I would just start singing to her, "You can't always get what you want."
Yeah, yeah.
And she looked at me, and it was like totally not what she expected. And then now she sings it back to me. So now it's this funny thing. So whenever you can provide laughter and lightness and joy in a situation that's very serious. And if you're youth ministry people, that's what they're going to expect from you anyway. So you kind of have that going for you, that we're kind of tagged as like the people that are playful. But it really does diffuse the situation. And I've got a little clip for you I want to share of an example of what this could look like. Love that. Yeah. What if we had in our minds a way every time we needed to move a group of people into a certain direction, or if we knew we were trying to create some kind of environment, that we thought about how can we make this really fun instead of saying we're just going to make people do this? What would happen if they put a sign next to the escalator that said, "It's better for your heart if you take the stairs"?
Yeah.
Or what if they just said, "Not working, this is out of order," and made people go on the stairs? Can you imagine the response? I think people would have been way more frustrated if they just said, "Escalator's out of service." But they made it fun. They moved people that direction, not in a forceful way, but in a way that gave people the choice, and people chose what they were wanting them to choose. If we can, in ministry, create incentive, create positivity, create laughter and love and joy, people will want to move towards that. And it's all the way down to the way you run a meeting. So think about it even in the context of the meetings that we have. How can we provide this type of climate? It starts with you and what you bring, but then it's also how you're setting it up for everybody in your space. All right, that's all I've got for you this morning. Are there questions before we finish up? If you want the slides from the session, I'm going to put my email up here in a minute so you can get that. I also wanted to let you know that we at Ministry Architects have this thing called an online diagnostic. And what it does is that you answer a few questions. It's about 10 or 15 minutes long. And it will give you a sense of where you are as far as building a sustainable ministry. Climate is one of the areas. But some of the other areas are things like volunteers and vision, staffing. So if that's something you're interested in, all you got to do is snap a picture of that or write it down. That link will take you to the page where you write in your info, and then you take the diagnostic. When you're done with the diagnostic, I'll get an email. They'll tell me that it's done, and then we'll set you up with a 30-minute call with one of our consultants, and they'll go through the results with you. So that's just a little gift for you all for being here. Thank you so much. And then this is my info. If you do want the slides or if you want links to the videos or any of that, and my cell phone number or email address is there as well. Thank you all so much. It's been lovely. I'll be back with the second session at 1:10.